It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. In our show today, ideas about why we lie, why we cheat, why we deceive, and why we still seem to believe so much of what we're told.
Hello. I'm sorry I'm late.
This is Dan Ariely.
I'm the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke. And what else?
And Dan studies cheating. And when and why we do it. A few years ago, Dan was on a business trip.
Actually, a consulting conference, and I meet John Perry Barlow.
It turns out that John Perry Barlow used to be a lyricist for the Grateful Dead.
I love the Grateful Dead, and I was very impressed with him.
Yeah, great guy to meet at a conference.
It was just delightful to meet somebody like him.
So they started talking.
And talking for a while, it turns out that he was also a consultant for Enron.
Huh. Grateful Dead to Enron.
It is one of the most stunning collapses in U.S. corporate history.
Enron was, of course, a giant energy company based in Houston, and for 6 straight years, Fortune magazine named it the most innovative company in America.
It's hard to believe that a company with revenues of some $100 billion last year would be filing for bankruptcy this year.
But those $100 billion in revenue? A lie, a fiction. It was totally made up because the company was cheating by making up sales figures. And they'd been doing it for years. And most people just assumed it was, you know, a few bad apples at the top. But it turned out that hundreds of people, accountants, managers, consultants, they were all in on the scam as well. And so when Dan Ariely met John Perry Barlow a few years later at that conference, he was curious about whether he was involved too.
And I asked him about that. And he basically said he didn't see anything going bad. He believed in the company in an unbelievable way. He said he kind of suspended his own understanding of reality and was very happy to buy into a new reality. And then, of course, the moment Enron collapsed, he basically asked himself, how could I believe that?
Yeah, I mean, how could he have been there and not seen any of that?
And, you know, he's a very smart guy. And it's very hard to take somebody you admire and think highly of and basically said, this is a crook. And instead, this basically proposed a very different mechanism. If you were getting paid by Enron, wouldn't you want to see reality in the way that they were presenting it? And the interesting thing is that if you think that Enron was just kind of 3 bad people, you would say, hey, let's just stop hiring bad people, or let's find ways to kick them out, or... But if you think that it's wishful blindness, and all of us are capable of that, that basically requests a very, very different approach.
That approach? It opened Dan to the possibility that maybe, instead of a few really bad apples, there might be a lot of kind of bad apples. Dan picks up the idea from the TED stage.
So, like we usually do, I decided to do a simple experiment. And here's how it went. If you were in the experiment, I would pass you a sheet of paper with 20 simple math problems that everybody could solve, but I wouldn't give you enough time. When the 5 minutes were over, I would say, pass me the sheets of paper and I'll pay you $1 per question. People did this, I would pay people $4 for their task. On average, people would solve 4 problems. Other people I would tempt to cheat. I would pass the sheet of paper. When the 5 minutes were over, I would say, please shred the piece of paper, put the little pieces in your pocket or in your backpack, and tell me how many questions you got correctly. People now solve 7 questions on average. Now, it wasn't as if there was a few bad apples, a few people who cheated a lot. Instead, what we saw is a lot of people who cheat a little bit. Now, in the economic theory, cheating is a very simple cost-benefit analysis. You say, what's the probability of being caught? How much do I stand to gain from cheating, and how much punishment would I get if I get caught? And you weigh these options out, you do the simple cost-benefit analysis, and you decide whether it's worthwhile to commit the crime or not. So we tried to test this. For some people, we varied how much money they could get away with, how much money they could steal. We paid them 10 cents per correct question, 50 cents, $1, $5, $10 per correct question. You would expect that as the amount of money on the table increases, people would cheat more, but in fact, it wasn't the case. We got a lot of people cheating, but still by a little bit. What about the probability of being caught? Some people shredded half the sheet of paper, so there was some evidence left. Some people shredded the whole sheet of paper. Some people shredded everything, went out of the room, and paid themselves from a ball of money that had over $100. You would expect that as the probability of being caught goes down, people would cheat more, but again, this was not the case. Again, a lot of people cheated by just by a little bit, and they were unsensitive to these economic incentives. So we said, if people are not sensitive to the economic rational theory explanations, to these forces, what could be going on? And we thought maybe what is happening is that there are two forces. At one hand, we all want to look at ourselves in the mirror and feel good about ourselves. So we don't want to cheat. On the other hand, we can cheat a little bit and still feel good about ourselves. So maybe what is happening is that there's a level of cheating we can't go over, but we can still benefit from cheating at a low degree as long as it doesn't change our impressions about ourselves. We call this like a personal fudge factor. Now, how would you test a personal fudge factor? Initially, we said, what can we do to shrink the fudge factor? So we got people to the lab, and we said, we have two tasks for you today. First, we asked half the people to recall either 10 books they read in high school or to recall the 10 commandments. And then we tempted them with cheating. Turns out, the people who tried to recall the 10 commandments, given the opportunity to cheat, did not cheat at all. It wasn't that the more religious people, the people who remembered more of the commandment, cheated less, and the less religious people, the people who couldn't remember almost any commandment, cheated more. The moment people thought about trying to recall the 10 commandments, they stopped cheating. Now, 10 commandments is something that is hard to bring into the education system, so we said, why don't we get people to sign the honor code? So we got people to sign. I understand that this short survey falls under the MIT honor code. Then they shredded it. No cheating whatsoever. And this is particularly interesting because MIT doesn't have an honor code.
That's amazing. So, I mean, when you introduce like an element of moral accountability, like signing an honor code, the students are less likely to cheat?
Yeah, so it's basically all about what are you thinking about? Now, I don't think this effect lasts very long, right? It's not as if we can get people to recite the Ten Commandments once a week and they'll be honest for the whole week. But at least it tells us something about the momentary mindset and saying that at the moment you could get people to think more deeply about honesty, to be more attentive. It does change your own understanding of what's right and wrong and your ability to rationalize at that moment. It's almost like an anti-rationalization mechanism to think about morality in this way.
Have you ever like taken some printer paper home, like some just paper home to use in your home printer?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But I can justify that very easily.
But that's not really cheating or being deceitful, is it?
Actually, I'm being helpful. I get to work more at home. So
exactly.
They should bless it. What do you mean?
So, but why is that seen as bad behavior?
Well, I think the thing is that we have this capacity to rationalize all kinds of behaviors, like taking paper home.
Yeah.
But if it was money, and we said, would I take money from the office to buy paper for my home printer, I think we would think about it very differently.
Because that's wrong.
That's stealing.
That's stealing.
Yeah, yeah. But if the same thing is framed as something else, like a pencil or a piece of paper or something like that, all of a sudden we can think about it very differently. And maybe the word think is a bit strange because we basically don't think about it. And by not thinking about it very clearly, we're basically allowing ourselves to misbehave and still not think of ourselves as bad people.
Do you assume that everybody you meet or encounter is a cheater in some ways?
Well, I think of this as human. I don't think it's a cheater, but you know, in the same way that we have a hard time, you know, not overeating and saving money and all of those things. But dishonesty is also different in a sense that we teach our kids to lie. You know, nobody tells their kids that when they grow up they should always say, "Honey, you look terrible in that dress," right?
Yeah.
In the social realm, we do understand that people have some benefit from dishonesty, and it's an important lubricant for society. But then people move to the business world. And while I want my wife to care about my feelings, I don't want my accountant to care about my feelings. Think about something else. What happens if you're at a company and some of your friends are misbehaving? And now you have a conflict between your friendship, your loyalty to them, your loyalty to the company, and honesty.
Which brings us back to 2001, to
one of the most stunning collapses in U.S. corporate history.
And to Dan's friend, John Perry Barlow.
He basically said he didn't see anything going bad.
Now, Dan started all his research with one question. And the question was, are there just a few really bad apples, or are there lots and lots of kind of bad apples? But what if there isn't a huge difference between the two? Like, what if the worst of the worst start out like you and me? So for the past 2 years, Dan's been trying to figure out the answer to that question. He's been interviewing some of these really big cheaters.
And what they did at the end is just incomprehensible. And you say, I can't possibly see myself behaving this way.
Yeah.
But then you look at the details and you look at step one. And step one was often innocent and not selfish at all. It was to help other people. It is really this slippery slope of taking one step, often for something that at the moment people think is for a good cause.
I mean, I think that most of us have a limit, right? I mean, we have some kind of limit in our minds, and I mean, that slippery slope cannot apply to everyone.
So, of course, I don't know if it applies to everybody. So the first thing to recognize is that I think the ability to rationalize some dishonesty is within us all. On top of that, now there's a question of which of us would be able to just cheat a little bit from time to time and which ones of us would be able to go into a slippery slope. Let's assume that you admit that from time to time you're less than perfectly honest, but you've never been onto this slippery slope. And, you know, you go and you get a job, let's say a banker at Goldman Sachs, and there are things about the local culture and there are things about how people treat each other and there are things about how they talk about their clients and their ideology and so on. And you should ask yourself whether you think that you would be immune from a slippery slope under those conditions. And, you know, I don't have evidence for that, but I think it'll be hard to imagine that all of us who are good right now would not have a chance of being bad if we're in the wrong conditions.
Dan Ariely is a behavioral economist and psychologist at Duke University. You can watch all four of his talks at TED.com. When we come back, the human lie detector. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.